love Easter. I love what it's about, the reason, the thing we're celebrating. And I love seeing some people that we haven't seen in a while, like Rose Cook. Good to see you, sister. It's awesome that you're here. Rose Banks Cook. And others, so it's good to see you all. I looked in the mirror this morning, I thought, you know, I look like an Easter egg. So that's just right. All those colors, so y'all look great too. I know I look great. We're talking about the power of the resurrection today. And one of our greatest needs, I don't know if you feel this, I think we all do. I think one of our greatest needs is power. Most people I know, regardless of background or religious belief, have good intentions for the kind of lives that they want to lead. We know the kind of people that we want to be. We think about the kind of relationships that we'd like to have. We want good things, a good life. We want to do good things. We just seem to lack the power to make it happen. We just somehow can't do good stuff that we want to do, and life kind of trips us up. The late Charlie Shedd was a great writer and speaker. He said that before he had children, he used to do a talk called The Ten Commandments for Raising Children. And then he had a child, and he changed it to 10 Hints for Parents. And then he and his wife had another child and changed it to A Few Tentative Suggestions for Fellow Strugglers. And then they had a third child, and he just quit doing that talk altogether. Life has this way of showing us, no matter how grand our dreams and no matter how wise our plans, we simply lack the power to be who we want to be and do what we want to do. That's just being human. Then, as a matter of historical record, there was this small, powerless group of human beings who were followers of Jesus, who had all kinds of dreams and plans for what that meant for their nation and for the world and for their individual lives. But then he was rejected by the Jewish leaders and crucified by the Romans. He was dead and buried, and their hopes and dreams died with him. They were done. Then something happened. Now, you may not be a believer in God or a follower of Jesus, but something historical happened to create this movement. These people, who otherwise would have been just a minor footnote in Jewish history, were gripped by a conviction that something had happened that changed everything. They were convinced that Jesus was raised. Not just that, but also that the power that God used to raise Jesus from the dead was the ultimate expression of power over the ultimate enemy that human beings have always faced, death and all that's wrong in the world. That's expressed in death, spiritual and physical and everything. That same power that was demonstrated on Easter is now available for human life. In our struggles with our own brokenness and disappointments and sin, that's the claim that we're here to consider this morning. Paul put it like this when he was writing to a little group of believers. Again, this is about 2,000 years ago. Ephesians 1, 19 and 20, he said, he's praying, I pray that you may know God's incomparably great power for us who believe. That power is the same as the mighty strength he exerted when he raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms. I want to talk about that power in the lives of ordinary people like you and me. I believe that resurrection power is our only hope and the only hope for the human race. I want to talk about it by telling you a story. The story actually goes way back before Jesus. It's found in the Old Testament. It's about a man you've heard of, probably, by the name of David. That'll get us, I think, to the resurrection and what it means for all of us. At the beginning of David's life, quite remarkable things began to happen. This is a man of extraordinary gifts and potential. One day, a prophet by the name of Samuel sought out David's family and picked out David from among all his brothers and said that David had found favor with God. He actually anointed David. Great things are going to happen in this young man's life. And for a while, they did. David ends up going to court. He becomes a favorite of the king. King Saul just loves David. David was his favorite musician. He was a hero. David ends up becoming best friends with the king's son, Jonathan. And he marries the king's daughter, which is a really good career move in those days. He became a warrior. He was wildly successful. He's so heroic, people actually would sing songs about his greatness. This young man, David, everything he touched turned to gold. People thought he led a charmed life. Then a funny thing happened to him on his way to the top. It all fell apart. One by one, all those wonderful things that he achieved or was given began to be stripped away from him. He became so successful that King Saul became jealous of him, got jealous of the songs that the people would sing about David. He picked up a spear one day and actually tried to kill David, and David had to run for his life. So he loses his job, his income, his security. Some of you know what that feels like. Then he loses his marriage. Some of you know the pain of that too. Saul was trying to kill David. His wife helps David escape, but she ends up being taken back by Saul and given to another man to be his wife. Kings could do that in those days. So David now has also lost his marriage. He's lost his family. He's lost his position. He tries to go see Samuel, the prophet, his personal mentor. But Saul hears about it, sends soldiers, and David has to make another escape. Soon after this, Samuel dies. David will never get to see Samuel again. Never get advice or guidance from his old mentor and friend. He's gone. David tries to run to his best friend, Jonathan. Jonathan loves David, but Jonathan cannot lift a sword against his own father. So David has to run away one more time. He'll never see his best friend again. That's how bad it is for David, and then it gets worse. Israel is such a dangerous place for him now, he has to go into exile. So he loses his home, his culture, his language. Think about that. He's got nowhere to go. So he runs for refuge to a city outside of Israel called Gath. Gath of the Philistines, Goliath's hometown. David is so desperate that he runs for refuge to his enemies. He pretends to be insane. He foams at the mouth and scribbles on the gates, but they kick him out and he ends up living in a cave. This is David, who had once been in a palace, had wealth and power and fame and friends and security. He had a future. He was a golden boy, and now all of that's gone. He's got no money, no home, no friends, no job, no mentor. He's running for his life. He's living in a cave. The cave is where you end up when all your props and supports, all the scaffolding and gifts, all the awards and all that stuff gets stripped away from you. The cave is where you end up when you thought you were going to have a great life, do great things, have a great family, and all your hopes turn to dust. And it's clear that things will not work out the way you had always dreamed. A cave is a place where dreams go to die. And some of you I know, even in a room with this many in it, some of you are in a cave this morning. Maybe you had a vocational dream of what were you going to do, it hasn't happened. Maybe you're under enormous financial pressure. You wake up worried about it in the middle of the night. Maybe it's a relationship. Maybe you've lost a marriage to desertion, death, or divorce. Maybe you wanted a relationship so badly, but it just never happened and you're alone. Or maybe it did happen, then you were deeply disappointed or betrayed in it. You're in a cave. Maybe you made a bad decision from which you can't recover. You find yourself asking, how did I ever end up here? I had such bright hopes. I had such strong dreams. They were really good. Now I find I've made decisions. I'm involved in self-destructive behaviors. I don't even know who this person is. How did I end up here? You're in a cave of remorse. Maybe something happened to you through no fault of your own. Maybe your health is gone. or somebody you love more than yourself has lost his or her health. Maybe you find yourself all alone. Maybe you betrayed some of your most deeply held values in trying to learn how to live with that. A cave is a place of disappointment, of regret, of failure, of fear. It's a funny thing. Nobody plans on ending up in a cave. We live in a place and time where a lot of people pride themselves on their ability to avoid living in a cave. But sooner or later, everyone's going to log some time there. Maybe you're there now, maybe not yet. But sooner or later, that day will come. That's part of the brokenness of our world. By the end of our lives, if not before. And one of the most challenging things about being in a cave is to begin to wonder if God himself has lost track of you. You begin to wonder, did he forget his promises? Does he remember where I am? Does anybody out there hear me when I pray? Does he know that I'm here in this cave? Will I ever be anywhere else? Will I die in here? So there's one more thing you need to know. The cave is actually where God does some of his best work in molding and shaping and restoring human life. Sometimes when all the props and crutches and scaffolding and awards and achievements and diplomas and 401ks in your life get stripped away, then you find that all that you have is God. And you know, God's enough. Sometimes the cave is where you meet God, the God who does his best work in caves. It's a funny thing. When people look back on their lives, when you look back on your life, and you ask people, when was a time in your life when you really grew spiritually? A time when you met God and you learned to be patient or to trust what was going on? What was happening? And the answer is usually it was during times of suffering. It was that time that I was in a cave. Well, David spent about 10 years of his life in the desert, hiding in caves. 10 years. Everything was going great for so long, and he ends up in a cave and spends 10 years in the wilderness. He was not entirely alone. He did have some people come to him to form a little community, but they were not a real promising group. This is what the Bible says about them in 1 Samuel 22:2. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their commander. Promising group, right? A group of misfits. Would you like to lead that little band right there? They're in debt, they're in distress, they're discontent. David and his band of what some would call losers established a kind of refugee community in a village called Ziklag. They take wives. They have families. Then one day they return from battle, and guess what? It's all gone. Their village is gone. Their families, their wives, their sons, their daughters have all been taken captive. They've lost everything. And the text says in 1 Samuel 30, verse 4, so David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. You ever cry like that? Life hits absolutely rock bottom. These are outlaws and fugitives from their own country. They established a little refugee village. It's not much, but it's a place to call home. And now it's gone. And they're so overwhelmed by sadness, so crushed, they cried until they literally cannot cry one more tear. They wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. Have you ever been that low? And then for David, it gets worse. 1 Samuel 30, verse 6, David is greatly distressed because his own men were talking about stoning him. They were bitter, they were angry, they were disappointed. They wanted to take out their anger on the one in a position of leadership and responsibility. Ever had a really bad day at work? People really not happy with you? This is David, a fugitive from his own country. His king has tried to kill him. He's lost his mentor. He's lost his best friend. He's lost his wife. He's lost his future. He's lost his security. He's lost his reputation. He's lost his money. He lost his home. He finds the courage to launch a little startup in the middle of nowhere. They may be a bunch of losers, but they're all that he has. But things go south, and now even they want to kill him. And then comes, I think, one of the most amazing verses in the Bible. It's actually the last half of that other verse I just read. It's just one little phrase. We don't find out much of what's behind it. But the last part of 1 Samuel 30, verse 6, "But David found strength in the Lord his God." That's it. David found strength, not in his own resilience, not in his brilliance, not in his strategies, not in his determination, not in his friends, not in his family, not in his country, not in any of those things. He found strength in the Lord his God. Just that one sentence, and there in the mystery of a human being alone with his God, everything changed. Now, his circumstances were no different. Everything outside of him looks just the same as it did a moment ago. But David has passed from death to life. This account is really not about David at all, is it? It looked like the bottom had fallen out of his life. It turns out David had fallen into the arms of God. David found strength in the Lord his God. David had gone on to live quite a remarkable life. Eventually, he would be able to return to Israel. One day he'd become king. The people would look back on his time as king with so much longing that when they thought about a Messiah who might come one day to save them, they would talk about such a one as the son of David. If there could only be another king like that. Again, David would know great highs. He would know great lows. He would achieve great victories. He would make huge mistakes. I wonder how often for the rest of his life, maybe in his memory, but maybe even physically, he would go back and stand by that cave where he had once lived all alone and found strength in the Lord as God. I wonder if you've ever done that. I wonder if you know what it is when everything else is stripped away to find strength in God. Because it turns out that God understands all about caves. It turns out caves are why he sent Jesus. Turns out that when Jesus came, the one who is called the Son of David, for a little while, just like David, everything went great. For a little while, a lot of the stuff that Jesus touched turned to gold. People loved his teaching. They would come to Jesus. Those who were in distress and debt or discouraged, those who were sick or lame, lepers, the shunned, they would come to him and he would heal them. He would touch them. He would embrace them. And they loved him, and the word spread, and the crowds grew huge. A week ago on Palm Sunday, the people of Jerusalem were also excited about what he could do, about who he could be, about how their lives would be changed by him, that they line up along the road coming into Jerusalem. The atmosphere is full of tension because he's become a lightning rod, a political powder keg. But maybe he is actually the son of David. Maybe a new king has come. They throw their palm branches on his way and they cry out, "Hosanna to the Son of David." And they want to make him king. But he refused to be the kind of king they wanted. And when they found that out, they realized he was serious about that. He refused to be the kind of king they wanted and thought they needed. They felt, some of them, betrayed. They became angry, and Jesus, the son of David, also lost everything. His position as a teacher, his security, he lost his friends who abandoned him when he needed them the most. The son of David had a huge crowd of enemies too, some who were disheartened by his refusal to raise an army and be a king, some who were threatened by his popularity, his political potential, some who stood to lose their fortunes and their positions of power. He had powerful people who wanted to kill him. And this time, they did it. They arrested him and put him through a mockery of a trial. They convicted him on the basis of nothing. And they stripped him and beat him and put a crown of thorns on his head. They nailed him to a cross. It was sin and guilt that put him there, but not his sin, not his guilt. He was the most perfect man who'd ever lived, the only sinless human life. He endured the most unfair death that's ever been inflicted on anybody. It was their sin, but not just theirs. It was my sin too. It was your sin too that hung Jesus there on the cross where he died. Everybody thought, that's it. It's over. This man we thought was God's Messiah is dead. This movement that we've been swept up in is over. We're done. They took him down from the cross, put his dead body away where they thought it would never be heard of or seen again. Where they put his body? In a cave. But either they didn't know or they just forgot. God does the best work in caves. There's a small group of people who were the closest friends and followers of Jesus. When he died on the cross, they were distressed, dejected, demoralized, and frightened that his fate could be theirs too. But then something happened to them. You have to decide what you'll make of what it is that happened to them. But as a matter of history, something happened to them that caused them to be absolutely convinced that Jesus had been raised from the dead and was alive again. Now, that doesn't mean all the problems went away any more than it would for you or me. In many ways, all their problems were just exacerbated. They were just beginning. The sacrifices they would make were just getting started, and many of them did actually lose their lives because of this. They made huge financial sacrifices. They traveled around the world at a time when travel was difficult and dangerous. Many of them, as I said, gave their lives for this one that they loved. But here's the remarkable thing. They did it with joy. In their perspective, they were getting the deal of a lifetime. There was an unstoppable force of life inside them that transformed the world. Throughout history, it transformed the world. And now this is our day. Now this news comes to each of us, and there's a decision that we all have to make. A few years ago, a close friend of mine was going through a terrible time. His wife had become deeply disappointed in him, really for reasons beyond his control. She just didn't love him the way he was and had always been. She became involved in an affair with another man. He wasn't sure whether he wanted her back, and even if he did, he didn't think she would ever come back to him. He was in a deep, dark cave. He had been a devout Christian. In fact, he was a minister. But now he found himself plagued by doubt. Now he wasn't sure God even existed or cared. Now at the very point of his life that he most desperately needed resurrection power. But you know, it's in caves God does some of his best work. The cave is where God resurrects dead stuff. My friend turned to prayer in a desperate attempt to save his life. He inhaled the Bible, put his nose in the Bible and left it there. My friend turned to prayer, and finally he decided he did want to try to save his marriage. He found strength in the Lord as God, and by the power of God, the dead came back to life. That wasn't the end of his struggles. Life did not become easy, but it was a term for his emotional health and his marriage, and he's still happily married to that woman today. It doesn't always end that way, but in his case it did. Jesus went to the cross on purpose. He went there because he knew that our destiny is death. He knew that without God's power in our lives, we are hopeless. And because he loved us enough to make that sacrifice for us. Such amazing love. I love the passage that was read to us a few moments ago. Hebrews 12, 1 and 2. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus scorned the pain and shame of the cross because of the joy that was set before him. What was that joy? Your salvation, mine, eternal life. That's amazing love.